Sometimes it causes me to tremble. Were you there when they crucified my Lord?
Thank you for listening to Earthwatch tonight here on BAI. Please send an email to your host, Robert Knight. That's R-K-N-I-G-H-T at WBAI.org.
And were you there when they laid his precious body in the tomb? Oh, sometimes it causes me tremble. And were you there when they laid him in the tomb?
I and I are Rastafari.
Due to popular demand, we, the award-winning Midnight Ravers, will continue our exploration of Rastafarianism. So please join us on Friday, January 24th, 2014, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m., as we proudly present Blacker Black, Nyabingi Voice of the Lion, Part 2, only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. Miss it and hate yourself.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
From the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, I'm Deborah James with Healthcare 411, information for better health. One out of 110 children in the U.S. has an autism spectrum disorder, which includes autism, Asperger syndrome, and pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. Common to these disorders are repetitive behaviors, trouble communicating, and difficulty with social interactions. Some children may also have impaired cognitive skills and sensory perception. A new free guide from ARC gives parents further insight into these conditions and the various treatment options available. ARC's Dr. Stephanie Chang explains.
This free guide is titled Therapies for Children with Autism Spectrum Disorders. It offers descriptions of various treatments and an explanation of benefits and harms. This way, parents can be better informed to discuss the possible treatment options with their child's pediatrician.
For the free guide, visit effectivehealthcare.ahrq.gov. Healthcare 411 is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
The hour of the wolf is the hour between night and dawn. It is the hour when most people die, when sleep is deepest, when nightmares are most real. It is the hour when the sleepless are haunted by their deepest fear, when ghosts and demons are most powerful. The hour of the wolf is also the hour when most children are born. Ingmar Bergman's Hour of the Wolf. The hour in which reality becomes a mockery of madness, and masks hide behind faces. The hour of all final moments. Liv Ullmann in Ingmar Bergman's Hour of the Wolf, a diary of truths and lies like truths.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a recorded edition and a semi-repeat, we'll be listening to an interview conducted with Ken Liu last March. This is a fascinating one. Stay tuned.
Foundation.
Really?
Sure that, yes.
I have to look them up.
Yeah, it's a beautiful. They do a great job of recognizing translations, because I think oftentimes we don't really pay enough attention to translations. Period, like you were saying, and it's great that there's an award established to recognize that. So anyway, so that's how I got started, and after that I realized that there. You know, I'm sort of in an interesting position because there's a lot of really great, wonderful science fiction and fantasy being written in Chinese, and almost none of it is known to the West because they're not translating to English. And because they're not translating to English, most readers in the United States and England and other Anglophone countries just don't know about their existence at all, let alone appreciating them. So, you know, I thought that because I do know these works, and I think I'm somewhat competent at translating, I would make more of an effort to bring more of them into English. So since then, I've done a bunch of translations of short fiction by various writers like Xia Jia and Ma Boyong and other Chinese writers who are very well known in China, but not so much here in the West. And the stories I've translated have generally been well received. And so I'm glad to see that my instinct was right and that you know, great literature gets appreciated everywhere, regardless of the language, and that these barriers of culture and language can be overcome with an effective translation. So now onto your point about translation. I think translation is a very interesting topic, especially when you're talking about translation of science fiction and fantasy, because a lot of times people feel that science fiction especially should be easier to translate in some sense than other types of literature, because the idea is...
That's not the assumption I would make, because new concepts...
Well, actually, this is why people make that assumption, because the global language of signs is English. So when you're talking about new concepts and new technical terms...
That's funny, the lingua franca?
Yes, exactly. these new concepts and new terms are almost always expressed in English and then borrowed and translated into the various languages that the scientists are, speak natively. So the terms that are science fictional, you know, genetic engineering, transgenetic crops, artificial intelligence, that sort of thing. When you go to other languages, you find that their terms for these concepts are basically translations of the English terms. So, because English is the global language of science. So, the natural assumption is, well, since all these terms are derived from English, then it should be easy to translate back and forth, because they're all sort of, you know, it's sort of like that old joke where you think, when you're a kid, you think that people who speak other languages are not really speaking other languages, they're just speaking English, only with a weird different accent. And so that's sometimes how people sort of perceive science fiction. But in practice, that's not true. Those technical terms and the technical concepts turn out to be the easiest things to translate when you're going between languages for speculative fiction. What's much harder to get across are the humanistic aspects behind the science fiction. You know, science fiction isn't just about let's come up with a big idea about how to save humanity against some impending disaster, or you know, how to deal with an alien invasion. There's that part of it is interesting for readers, but to me, the much more interesting stuff is how different cultures and different writers who write in different languages deal with the human drama behind these concepts very differently. Because even though science fiction and fantasy are about, you know, imaginative worlds, the very human emotions are drawn from the writer's real experiences, and they're intended for a readership in that language, in that culture, who share certain assumptions. And when you're trying to do translation, you realize how much slippage there is and how much a lot of these things are different between the various cultures and languages, and things that are assumed to be true or that are naturally true for one author and one readership are not true when translating to a different language and for different readers. So it's been actually quite challenging to make this work. And I think a good translator, you know, people sometimes emphasize how a good translator has to have a good understanding of the source language and have really good intimate understanding of the nuances of the source language. And that's true, but I think not enough emphasis is placed on the ability of the translator to express concepts in the target language. So in some sense, I would say that a good translator is not necessarily someone who really, 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 really understands the source language and culture in such detail that he can be considered a scholar, but rather someone who has the necessary skills as a writer in the target language to convey what nuances he can understand in an effective way. It doesn't do any good for somebody who is a scholar of the source culture and the source language if that person is unable to express with subtlety and with grace in the target language, because all that understanding is sort of wasted. So I think people should place more emphasis, or at least equal emphasis, on the ability of the translator to write, because translation really is not about blindly finding synonyms and putting them down on paper in a different language, but rather recreating one piece of art in a different language, culture, context for a different readership, and to do it in a way that balances fidelity to the source as well as expressiveness and beauty of language in the new work of art. Translation really, a good translator, in my opinion, really should treat his work as an act of creation. And really believe that you know, he or she is trying to create a new piece of art that's based on the original, sort of like a sketch, not a photographic copy.
Yeah. So therefore, it sounds like from what you're saying that it's really a collaboration.
Yes, actually, I would say that the best translations result from a good collaborative working relationship between the translator and the author, because surprisingly, there can be a lot of conflicts between what the author intended and what the translator thinks will work, because there are certain, you know, this probably is familiar to a lot of writers. You write a story, and there are some aspects of the story that's very important to you, and then you show it to beta readers, and the readers get a totally different sort of meaning, sense out of it than what the writer intended. That actually happens quite a lot between authors and translators. The author...
That actually happens quite a lot between authors and readers.
Right. Exactly. That's the part that I think people understand. But between author and translator, there's a similar dynamic. The author intends certain things that are very important, or he thinks are very important to the story, that he thinks are critical to the work of art he created. But when translating to a new context, those may not be the very same aspects that are of interest or important to the target readership. There are certain things that the source audience takes for granted and therefore draws meaning from certain things. But the target readership would have a different set of assumptions and different semantic associations and different emotional responses. And you kind of have to balance that. I'm not advocating that people should take the source and just sort of use it as a blueprint while you write a new story based on it. That's not what I'm advocating. The translator has to be faithful above all to the original art, because, you know, the reader is here to read to get some sense of the original, not to read your interpretation. But in some ways, you can't get away from the fact that you will have to do some interpreting. And yet, you have to balance between this desire to be faithful to the original vision, and at the same time, not make it so alien, so divorced from the target culture language that it becomes inaccessible. So it's a hard balancing act.
It must be very difficult, because I'm thinking that as a writer yourself in interpreting this other person's work, all of a sudden people are reading something of another writer, and it's like, ooh, well, there's sort of a trope that Ken Liu has used.
Right, exactly. That's the sort of thing you want to avoid, right? You don't want to be... So I think a translator would be a failure if he or she translates a bunch of stories by different writers, and then the reader reads them and says, they all sound the same. You know?
Well, it's happened in movies. Steven Spielberg just announced that he's doing another Stanley Kubrick script. He had already done AI,
yep,
which Kubrick was developing actually with a couple of science fiction
yes.
writers, including, I think, Ian Watson and Brian Aldiss in England.
Mm-hmm.
And then he died at age 70, and Spielberg made the movie. And there are parts that are Kubrickian.
Yes, exactly. You feel like there are parts that are very Kubrickian.
Ultimately, it's a Spielberg
yes,
film.
Yes, exactly.
And so now Spielberg is doing Kubrick's, I think it's, is it Napoleon as a miniseries?
I think so, yeah.
And it's going to be Spielberg. My point is that not even Spielberg, he had this dilemma. I read interviews with him that I thought were very interesting, that he didn't know whether he had to be true to his abilities as a great movie maker, or if he had to try to ape who he considered one of his role models and gods in movie making, Kubrick. And, nobody can make a Kubrick film but Kubrick. People have tried for decades. They can't do it. And neither could Spielberg. So he mm-hmm. ended up doing a Spielberg film.
Right.
So it must be a very, very difficult line to walk.
Yeah, it's a very difficult line to walk. And in fact, there's also the added layer that I've had a lot of my stories in English translating to Chinese. So I know very well how this feels from the other side when you're the author and somebody else is doing the translation and you can understand the translation and you sort of see what choices the translator made and you sort of decide whether you agree or don't agree. And the thing is, the first few times it happens, I think as an author you tend to be extremely protective of your work. At least I was. The first few times I was translated, I was very protective, and I wanted to, the translator would make a decision, and I would agonize over it. And I would be like, okay, is this choice faithful to what I wanted to do? Do I still feel after this decision has been made, this is still my story, or do I feel it's no longer mine? So I agonize over a lot of these kind of choices. And so I know how it feels from the other side. So when I'm doing the translation, usually because I know the original writers, I'm very respectful of these issues. So if I make a decision that I think is pretty substantive and big, I would try to run it by the author and try to explain why.
If you can. I mean, the problem is that...
Right, not always possible.
Spielberg can't talk to
exactly,
Kubrick.
Exactly. If it is possible, I would try to talk to the author and try to explain why I think a particular decision needs to be made, why this passage needs to be moved or perhaps even removed, and why perhaps we should add a phrase or a sentence here to explain things or to even change the emphasis a little bit for an Anglophone readership. And but over time, I've come to realize that people sort of focus a lot on this concept of lost in translation, the idea being that there's lots of nuances and meanings in the original that are lost when the translation happens. And that is true. That is true. That's inevitable. It's not possible to translate one work of art in a way that preserves every single nuance of the original.
No, it cannot be done.
It's just can't be done. I can give you a very simple example that will illustrate the point. So for example, take the word for God in Chinese, which is 上帝. Now, by God, I mean the Judeo-Christian concept of God. When, mm-hmm. In the West, when we say God in a capitalized G, that's usually what we mean. In China, the equivalent is 上帝, which is a term with a very, very complicated history. 上帝 is not a neologism. It's not a new word. It's not invented in Chinese in some recent It's an ancient word that existed since, you know, the days of the Oracle script. And it referred to the supreme being of the universe, this formless, not man-shaped kind of supreme being. And later on during Confucianism, it became sort of identified as the source and the basis for legitimacy of imperial rule. So Shangdi literally means supreme emperor. Well, actually, the term emperor is a little problematic because the Chinese
Well, that's the point. We're talking about idioms here, so you can't say it in English.
The Chinese term for that's usually translating to English as emperor is not obviously emperor. So the point is, Shangdi had this very long history of a certain meaning. And then the Jesuit priests during the Ming Dynasty, when they went to China, wanted to convert locals into Christianity. And the way they did it was the Jesuits were mainly accommodationists, cultural accommodationists. They believed that to make Christianity effective as a religion in China, you had to sort of adopt Christian concepts to suit cultural practices that are local to China and not impose European ideals onto the Chinese, which put the Jesuits into a lot of conflict with the Pope back in Rome. But anyway, the point is...
And a lot of missionaries historically would find the local gods wherever they were and turn those gods into the devils.
Right. And
you see, ours is better.
Right. And the Jesuits actually...
You want to use Android, not Apple.
Right, exactly. And the Jesuits were actually very interesting. They took the term Shangdi and said, okay, so we're going to take this approach, which is that the Chinese culture is very ancient and learned, and we're not going to fight them on this point. What we're going to say is that just kind of like, you know, sort of like the old classical philosophers of Greece, they were pagans, but they in their writings and in their philosophy, you could see echoes of later Christian concepts. Mm-hmm. So in some way, the Platonic ideas and these Greek philosophers were really talking about Christian concept. They just didn't know that Christ was coming. So they took a similar approach to the Chinese classics, and they said that, you know, if you study the Confucian classics very deeply, you will see that there are echoes of later Christian doctrines coming. So it's not that we're teaching you something completely new. We're just trying to teach you to understand your own classics better, to see how they fit into the Christian view. And so they translate, one of the earliest missionaries made the decision to translate God as Shangdi, to identify God with the supreme being that had been existent in Chinese culture forever. And this was a very controversial decision. You know, it caused a lot of controversy back in Rome, a lot of controversy in China.
Yeah.
Like, is this a proper translation? You know, this is sort of, you know, it's fascinating to think about how these translation matters have always been you know, points of contention throughout history. So anyway, the point is eventually Shangdi did become the term for God. And this imported Western idea that identified the Judeo-Christian God with Chinese Shangdi actually took over and became the dominant meaning.
Yeah.
So the Chinese no longer think of Shangdi in the classical ancient sense of, you know, supreme being of classical ancient Chinese worship, but rather when they speak of Shangdi in modern Chinese, most Chinese would picture the guy with the white robe and the white beard.
Yeah,
pretty similar to what we, you know, think as children. As
and such is the nature of imperialism, wherever it derives from.
Sure. So what I'm getting at is when a story I translated by the Chinese novelist Liu Cixin, he had a story called Shanyang Shangdi, which literally translates as taking care of God, which is what I ended up using as the title. There's a lot of complexities to that, to those layers of meaning, because when a Chinese person reads Shangdi, what he's thinking about is there's this entire history of Western missionaries in China and the entire history of how Christianity first tried to accommodate to Chinese culture and later became very oppositional to it, and how it became the ideology of the revolutionaries. You know, very important revolutionaries, Feng Xiuquan, Sun Yat-sen, all these people embraced Christianity as a way to change the traditions of China. So
yeah.
So when you talk about Shangdi in China, there's a definitive sense, a certain emotional reaction and a certain kind of association with the word that is just absent when you talk about God to a a reader in the United States or England or Australia, who, you know, would each have slightly different reactions to it, but it's certainly not the same as the Chinese reader's reaction to Shan Di.
Yeah.
So similarly, Shan Yang, the other term in the title, has no exact English equivalent. It refers to a Confucian ideal about the duty of a child to take care of his or her parent in old age.
Wow. Okay.
And you know, we don't really have an English.
So a two-word title,
right,
has two idiomatic issues.
Yes.
Not one.
Exactly. There are many layers,
and they're very important.
They're very important. There are many layers of complexity to this. So a Chinese reader reading Shan Yang Shan Di has a definite emotional reaction right away to it that an English reader just won't get. But here's what's important. Lots of stuff is lost in translation in the sense of meanings, emotional reactions, and all these semantic associations that are present for the original readership will not be present in the new readership. But what's important is don't focus only on what's being lost. Let's focus also on what's being gained.
Yes.
There's a lot gained in translation as well. The fact is, you know, when I translated that story over into English, which is, so I'll give you a brief synopsis of the story, and this is a story that you can read online now because it's been published. So taking care of God is about the idea that one day aliens essentially came to Earth and claimed that they were actually God, in the sense that they created human beings.
Mm-hmm.
That is, they're a star-faring civilization who long ago came to Earth.
And by the way, hi to Eric von Däniken.
So right.
Back to sorry.
Story. So they came to Earth a long time ago and engineered the biosphere and manipulated history to basically create Earth civilization. And now that they've been wandering the stars for millennia, they're old and they're in their dotage and they no longer can take care of themselves. So they came back to Earth and said, you know, you're our children and we created you a long time ago, but now we're old and we no longer have the ability to take care of ourselves. Would you take care of us and let us live with you?
Which is actually very much the way generations tend to work.
Yep.
Parents need their children to take care of them,
right,
when they reach a certain point.
That's right. So the story is, you know, about this, how Earthlings react to this news and how they treat these former creators of theirs now that they're no longer powerful and they're in their dotage and they need help. So the story, you know, has a lot of resonance for Chinese audiences because the whole idea of taking care of your aged parents is coming to conflict with a mobile modern society in which, you know, children no longer live with their parents and they pursue careers that take them away from home and so on and so forth, where the extended family is breaking down into the nuclear family, etc. So there's a lot of complexity and resonance for a Chinese readership. But in English, it's surprising how effective the story still works. And it works, it's affecting in a different way because the English reader isn't reacting to the same cultural background and the same nuances that were present in the Chinese original, but they're reacting to different emotional echoes and different nuances that are present for us. You know, we have our family relationships in the West that are very different. We have issues about you know, what do we do with people who, as we engage in these end-of-life medical practices that extend their life on and on to the point where the quality of life has, you know, declined greatly. What is our moral responsibility and what is, you know, the right thing to do? And what is our emotional reaction to this sort of problem? And for the West, which is, you know, has always had this very strong emphasis on individualism and progress, or at least that is the ideological interpretation, which
yes,
people may dispute. How do you balance that with this obligation towards the past, this duty towards, you know, people who have a claim on your past, on where you came from? For the English reader, it turns out that the story is effective, but not at all in the same way that the Chinese story is effective. It's a different twist. It's a different reaction. And it's a different emphasis. I found it fascinating that essentially, the story in English is a different story that is clearly based on the Chinese original, but not the same one. It revealed aspects of the original that were not so obvious in the Chinese original, and it sort of brought into the open a lot of meanings that I had not thought about. And this whole idea about, you know, how would you deal with a literal interpretation of Judeo-Christianity, the creation myth, that is taking this very science fictional twist? What is, in fact, you know, the story goes on to posit.
It's like
that
the polar opposite of James Morrow,
right?
In which God dies and falls into the ocean and has to be towed away by the Exxon Valdez.
Right, the Exxon Valdez. I mean, the story posits that, you know, that humans are not alone, but in fact, these creatures who claim to be God created multiple other planets, and they went to all of them to ask to be taken in. So it's sort of like a Lear story in a way as well.
Yeah.
Which
planets among you love me the best?
Right, right. And there's this kind of...
It's
a fascinating kind of... to see how a translated work fits into a new, different... ecosystem of literary references and causes different reactions to the reader.
And the cultural differences in there.
Right.
It gives the story new life in a way.
Exactly. It gives the story new life.
Lost in translation, but here's a new concept added in translation.
Yes. So but
while keeping the purity of the author's
concept. Exactly. And I think people should embrace that. The fact that, you can be a total purist in the sense of, when you're reading a translation, you're not reading the original. So you're not going to experience the same work as the original.
Yeah, I know too many people who say, I'm not going to read that book unless I can learn the language.
Right. There
are people who do just that.
Right, right. And that's a perfectly respectable view.
And I do watch movies only in their original language, but I do depend on the subtitles. But I want to hear the intonation of the actors.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get both, and very often I will, over time, I will have learned enough French, enough German, enough whatever, to say, wait a minute, that's not what that actor just said, is it?
Right, right. Wait, that's not what the subtitles really say.
Yeah,
right.
And it could be that the subtitle, watching a Russian science fiction movie, Kinzaza. Wonderful, weird little movie.
I haven't seen that, okay.
Oh, yeah, it's worth seeing. And I had a translation in English, and one of the characters exclaimed something in Russian, and the subtitle said, "Crikey!"
You're like, that can't be really what they said.
And it's like, okay, number one, now we know more about the translator than we did about
right.
the movie.
Right.
He's Australian.
Right. And you wonder, what was the original idiom that got translated?
Exactly.
Right.
And that in and of itself was funny. The problem was it also took me out of the movie.
Right.
It also took me out of the story. Thank God it's a light comedy.
Right.
But with sort of Douglas Adams overtones, so it had a very serious aspect underneath it. But therein lies the fun and the problem itself of being taken out of the piece in order to deal with the different iterations it has had.
Yes.
There was. A Japanese version of The Borrowers made recently by Ghibli, I can't say it right, Studios,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, The Borrowers became renamed, as it often does, The Secret Life of Arrietty. And there is a British dubbed version and an American dubbed version. They're totally different. Same animation, same story, and God knows what the language of the Japanese version is.
Mm-hmm.
But just watching the English versus the American, hearing the English versus the American voiceovers makes me want to see the movie with subtitles.
It's different, right?
And hear the original actors.
Yeah, that's totally true. So anyway, I think people should try to embrace the fact that a translation is a new work of art, and it will not be a total preservation of the original, but it will be a different work and quite interesting in itself.
And I am interrupting this interview with Ken Liu to tell you that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. And this is a pre-recorded program allowing for snow and ice, traveling from Brooklyn to Harlem did not seem like the wisest move, parking and different issues. I'm calling this the Snowy Owl Edition. Snowy because, well, in New York City, we had a good almost 10 inches of snow. Owl Edition because of the hour, and the Snowy Owl Edition because, well, there's snowy owls all over the New York, New Jersey area, apparently, and I'm very tempted to go out and seek one out for advice, if nothing else. But at any rate, we are listening to an interview recorded last March with Ken Liu, that's L-I-U, and we will now continue.
Well, this is thoroughly fascinating and not only worth a show in its own, but we've spent 40 minutes on it.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, yeah. The time just flew by.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk a little bit about Ken Liu.
Okay.
How would you describe yourself as a writer? And I don't just mean genre. I mean
right.
Thematically, who is Ken Liu?
I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. I think in some ways I'm still trying to figure that out. Although I suppose in some way all writers are trying to figure that out, at least. I think if you don't try to figure that out if you don't try to learn something new about yourself or try to do something new yourself with every work, and then you're sort of
And you're still relatively young. Your output is only just begun.
I hope I'm still young. So I'm exploring a lot of things. I'm trying to figure out what is the story that matters to me. I've had this philosophy that for some writers, maybe myself included, what they really have in them is one ideal story that they're trying to tell in various ways. Mm-hmm. That all of their stories can be seen as echoes of that Platonic ideal story that they have in their heads that they're trying to reach towards. So with every new story they compose, they're trying in various ways to sketch some projection of that ideal story into the world of reality, and that they may never succeed, but whatever stories they write, you can always trace them back to that ideal story in their head that they're trying to tell. And maybe that's what I'm doing, because I think there are thematic...
I think it's fair to say that when I read one of your works, I don't necessarily, circumnavigate and come to this is the theme of that writer. But I do get a sense that if somebody had ripped the cover title off of it, I might have guessed you wrote it.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I've had that happen. I mean, I participate in these fiction contests where, it's just a group of writers trying to critique each other's work and submit stories on a theme anonymously, so we can all sort of comment on each other and without the friendships and the reputations getting in the way. And I have heard people say that my stories are very identifiable even without my name on there, that they can tell it's my story even though my name is not on there. So there is a sense in which that kind of thematic sort of voice presence is pretty strong.
I've had interviews with writers where I said, "Oh, you've got a new book out. Come on, let's do a show." And they say, "Well, it's not science fiction." It's like, "Yeah, so, it's like it's still your work,
right?
It's still a part of the body of what you have done." And lo and behold, I get to read that work, and even though it's not within the genre, I can tell it's from that writer, and I can tell that it's within that person's body of work.
Right.
And so what's the theme? In your case, it's Ken Liu.
I hope it's not all Ken Liu all the time. That would be...
getting back to, now I don't dare say the Chinese name for God, Shangdi. Shangdi.
Uh-huh.
As somebody might say that, and that's sort of an idiomatic word.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that in this sense, Ken Liu is an idiomatic concept that can be
okay.
found in different stories. How's that?
Okay. That is probably a little more palatable. I don't know if there's a way to put what I...
I'm sorry, but listeners should see how pleased I am with myself. I haven't said that, but go on.
thank you. That was actually very well done. I don't know if I can put into words what my thematic concerns are, but there's a sense in which I'm trying to figure out... science fiction often is described as being very concerned with the future, but I'm not sure my work is very... much in that vein. I certainly talk a lot about the future and the meaning of technology and how technology changes concepts that we take for granted and how it changes what it means to be human. But a lot of my stories, I think, have this very deep sort of lingering sense of being concerned with the past in the context of the future. That is, as we're talking about progress, future inventions, and solving our problems of the present day with technology, there's also a sense in which my stories are really very much looking backwards and looking into history and trying to figure out what does the experience of our parents, our grandparents, and generations before mean in the context of this march towards progress. Is this really time's arrow or time's cycle? Is this really a view, a teleological view of the universe, or something more that talks about a recurring pattern, cyclical nature of history? So a lot of my stories are really centered around meditations on these different views of what it means to remember, to embrace the past at the same time that you're moving forward. Because I don't think it's possible to really talk about the future without in some way coming to terms with the past. So a lot of my stories are focused on that, on the passage of the generations, on the way things are passed from generation to generation, on the way meaning changes over time, on the way we can embrace the past while also at the same time critiquing aspects of it and make it meaningful without completely changing it. So in some ways, I guess my work is really about translation too. It's about translating the past for the future, and how to reinterpret and interpret and understand and empathize with the past at the same time that you're moving forward.
Yeah.
So that's a sort of thematic preoccupation.
Shards of reality, really, is what it comes down to,
mm-hmm.
I think,
mm-hmm.
Which is a wonderful way of looking at, well, all of it, whatever it may mean.
Whatever it means.
Yeah. Why don't you read a story for us?
Okay, I brought along...
Do you want to take a break?
I can dive right in. I think I'll be okay.
Okay, great.
Okay, so I brought along a flash piece that I wrote, which I like a lot.
And we should just explain to listeners who don't know, flash means a short story.
A very short story.
Yeah.
This one is under 1,000 words, and it was published in Daily Science Fiction, I believe, last year. And it's one of my favorite pieces.
And again, just to translate for listeners, Daily Science Fiction is a website that publishes a story a day.
Yep, and you can subscribe to it, and it's free.
Yeah.
Okay, so the story is called Memories of My Mother. Age 10. Dad greeted me at the door, nervous. Amy, look who's here. He stepped aside. She looked exactly the way she did in the pictures hung everywhere in our house. Black hair, brown eyes, smooth, pale skin. Yet she also felt like a stranger. I put down my book bag, unsure what to do. She walked over, leaned down, and hugged me, first loosely and then very tight. She smelled like a hospital. Dad had told me that the doctors had no cure for her sickness. She had only 2 years left to live. You're so big. Her breath felt warm and tickly on my neck, and suddenly I hugged my mother back. Mom brought me presents, a dress that was too small, a set of books that were too old, a model of the rocket ship she rode in. I was on a very long trip, she said. The ship went so fast that time slowed down inside. Felt like only 3 months. Dad had already explained it all to me. This was how she would cheat time, stretch out her 2 years, so that she could watch me grow up. But I didn't stop her. I liked listening to her voice. I didn't know what you would like. She was embarrassed by the gifts that surrounded me. Gifts that were meant for another child, the daughter of her mind. What I really wanted was a guitar, but Dad thought I was too young. If I had been older, I might have told her that it was all right, that I loved her gifts anyway. But I was not yet so good at lying. I asked her how long she would stay with us. Instead of answering, she said, "Let's stay up all night, and we'll do everything Dad says you can't do." We went out, and she bought me a guitar. I finally fell asleep at 7 in the morning in her lap. It was a fantastic night. When I woke up, she was gone. Age 17. "Why the hell are you here?" I slammed the door in my mother's face. "Amy." Dad opened the door again. Seeing him next to my mother, still 25, still exactly the same woman from the pictures, I suddenly realized how old he had grown. He was the one who held me when I was scared out of my wits by the blood I found in my panties. He was the one who, vet-faced, mumbled to the store clerk to beg her to fit me for a bra. He was the one who stood there and held me while I screamed at him. She has no right to dip back into my life once every 7 years, like some fairy godmother. Later, she knocked on my bedroom door. I stayed in bed and said nothing. She came in anyway. She had crossed light years to get here, and a plywood door wasn't going to stop her. I liked that she pushed her way in to see me, and I also hated it. It was confusing. "That's an elegant dress," she said. My prom dress was hanging from the back of the door. It was elegant and cost me half my savings, but I had torn it carelessly near the waist. After a while, I turned around and sat up. She was in my chair, sewing. She had cut a guitar-shaped piece from her own silver dress and patched it over the tear in mine. It was perfect. "My mother died when I was a little girl," she said. "I never got to know her, so I decided that I would do something different when I found out." It was strange to hug her. She could have been my older sister. Age 38. Mom and I sat together in the park. Baby Debbie was asleep in the stroller, and Adam was with the other boys by the jungle gym, screaming with joy. "I never got to meet Scott," she said, apologetic. "You weren't dating last time I visited, during grad school." "He was a good man," I almost said. "We just grew apart." It would have been easy. I had been lying for so long to everyone, including myself. But I was tired of lying. He was an ass. It just took me years to admit it. "Love makes us do strange things," she said. Mom was only 26. When I was her age, I had been full of hope, too. Could she really understand my life? She asked me how Dad had died. I told her that he went peacefully, even if it wasn't true. There were more lines on my face than on hers, and I felt that I needed to protect her. "Let's not speak any more of sad things," she said. And I was angry with her for being able to smile, and I was also glad that she was there with me. It was confusing. So we spoke about the baby and watched Adam play until it was dark. Age 80. "Adam?" I asked. "It's hard for me to turn the wheelchair, and everything seems so dim in my eyes. It can't be Adam. He's been really busy with his new baby. Maybe it's Debbie, but Debbie never visits." "It's me," she says, and squats down before me. I squint. She looks still the same, as always. But not exactly the same. The smell of medicine is stronger than ever, and I can feel her hands are shaking. "How long have you been traveling?" I ask. "Since you started." 2 years and counting," she says. "I'm not leaving again." I'm sad to hear this, and yet I'm also happy. It's confusing. "Was it worth it?" "I got to see less of you than most mothers, but also more." She pulls up a chair next to me, and I lean my head on her shoulder. I fall asleep, feeling very young and knowing that she'll be there when I wake up. The end.
Yeah.
That's the story.
And it's a good one. It's touching.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Which I would say most of your writing is. First of all, they're entertaining. Second of all, they're very slice of life to me. I would say that's part of the voice
yes,
that you share is a slice of life kind of a voice. But they're also very humane, very touching. They somehow say something.
That's a good word. Humane, I think, is what I like. I go for. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's good. And I really, you know, sometimes I hear a story and it's like, no, a proper interviewer should have 1,000 questions after that. And I think, you know what, I think it spoke for itself. I think it said it and, you know.
Yeah, it's a short story and it does what it
it does what it set out to.
Yes,
do.
Yes.
Very much so. Why do you write primarily short stories?
I don't, I didn't set out to do so.
Okay, why do you publish? That's a better way.
Okay, well, here's the real reason, which is that my wife and I have two very young children. And as anybody who has very young children knows, it's just not very easy to concentrate and find chunks of time where you can focus on stuff. For me...
I used to get a lot of lit when I was on it at 5 in the morning. I had a lot of young parents listening just because they had no choice
exactly.
to be awake at that hour.
Exactly. you know, for me, ever since my second daughter was born, I think I've ended up doing lots of flash pieces, way more than I used to. And I think part of that is because that's about the length at which I can operate. So, I didn't intend to set out explicitly to do short stories, but that's... the practical answer for why that's the scope of what I do. But I am working on a novel. The universe is created by my wife and I together, but this novel is going to be primarily me working within that universe. It's coming along. It's an epic fantasy set on an imaginary archipelago influenced by vaguely by East Asian cultural practices. And the technology level is somewhat pre-steam. There are gods, there's magic, there are magical creatures. Hopefully it will also be fun and entertaining for readers. I really enjoyed working something long, and I've been working on this novel for a very long time. So hopefully my daughters will give me sufficient chunks of time where I can actually finish it. That's my biggest goal for the year.
Mm-hmm. And a good one. It sort of puts you in a place in where you are in your life and what you're doing, I think, of just a little bit with Saladin Ahmed, who also has two young daughters.
That's right. That's
and
right.
And is also taking stuff from his cultural heritage,
mm-hmm.
which is arabesque.
Mm-hmm.
And putting that into a world of fantasy
yep.
with gods and
yep.
all that. And
I don't know how he does it. I mean, you know, I having two young children, it's just, I don't know how he managed to do it.
I don't think at this point Saladin knows how he does it either. Like, he used to be a New Yorker, we're friends. So it's difficult. It must be very difficult. And on top of that, you're a software developer.
I do software development. My day job is actually as a litigation consultant for a litigation support company. But on the side, I do some software development.
Wow. Okay.
As part of the various things that I do. Right now, my wife and I design and write these. Android and iOS apps that are meant for our daughters.
Yeah, but you know, I had fun playing with it.
Oh, good. Thank
on my
you.
It was it's interesting. You know, it's because I don't have any Mandarin. I don't have
right.
any language. I'm of German descent. I don't even have any German. But I love the other. I love
sure.
learning about what I don't know. I
sure.
hope most people do.
Well, I hope most people are curious.
Many people
and interested.
Are fearful of it. I go the other way. I try to embrace it now, and then it turns out to be fearful. That's another story.
Yes, but. And that's a healthy attitude, I think.
But no, I found, you know, the sort of a mental Fisher Price kind of thing from another world.
Sure.
But it gave me just the tiniest little insight there. Let me ask you one last question, because we're actually about out of time.
Okay.
Which is other media than the written word. Have you thought of playing in other media? And I'm very careful when I say that, because other media can be world building through software, games, cinema, theater, radio drama. He said meaningfully.
Yes, meaningfully.
Have you thought about either A, doing your own translations of your own work or other people's work into other media, or B, having others do it for you with what you've written? Your stuff is very easily, I think, adaptable for other media.
Oh, that's
Because it is slice of life stuff. And,
right.
And by the way, doesn't require a budget. It'd be great for theater. Think of it. It'd be great theater.
Yeah, it's true. I haven't actually thought about theater. I have thought about film and scripts.
That's the first thing people think of.
Yeah, that's definitely what a lot of people think about. And I mean, I admire film as a form. It's really sort of the main popular culture form that we have. I mean, you know, in terms of influence, you can't beat film.
Yeah, but you see, you're from Boston, I'm from New York. I think theater.
Okay, that's true. It depends on what you're thinking of specifically and what group you're really targeting. But, you know, I think film is fascinating. I've been interested in it for a long time, and I love to someday actually work in film in some capacity, scripting, whatever.
Directing.
Directing, yeah. So.
Well, I mean, in your case, I would think making your own movies of your own stories would be...
That would be interesting. I don't know how I feel about that. In some ways, I feel like it's almost easier to have someone else do the translation in that sense than to do it yourself.
Yeah, but if you were to take one of your stories and put it into Mandarin, would you hire somebody or would you do it?
I would... You know, I don't think I would do it myself. I think I would rely on somebody else to do it. Just because I think, philosophies on this probably differ. But I think, actually, that it's better to have some... Again, you know, this goes to the fact of whether how expressive you can be in the target language. I don't live in China, so I no longer have an ear for the dialogue of everyday life. I no longer have a sense of the way people use slang and the way that they're, you know, these things change on a minute-by-minute basis.
Yeah, absolutely.
You really have to be embedded in the culture to really have the full panoply of tools at your disposal. And so I've seen my own work translated by very skilled translators who are also writers. I mean, Xia Jia, who is one of the Chinese writers I've translated into English before, and she herself is also a very accomplished translator into Chinese. So she took one of my stories and did the translation into Chinese. And I read her
that translation. That makes a lot of sense, what you're saying.
Yes.
It really does.
And I read her translation, and my response was, there's no way I could have ever done what she did. Because what she did is she took my original, and then she recreated it in a much more vivid, lively, new way.
Her into a language that would be meaningful for the
Chinese
readers.
That's right. Her Chinese translation is
yours would probably be more classical.
Her translation is lively. It's filled with the air of the market. It's fresh. People talk in different voices. There's just a real, you know, liveliness to it that I can't possibly approach because I don't live there on a day-to-day basis.
So in the same context, then, you might want to turn something you've written over to a director.
Exactly.
Who is already versed in the tricks of cinema and film.
That's right.
This is, again, as you were saying earlier, it is all about translation, isn't it?
And it's about adding to it, not just preserving the original. You know, you can't go into a translation effort, whether it's translating to film or translating to another language, with the idea that the goal here is to preserve as much of the original as possible. That I think always leads to a horrible result. I mean, when you do good film adaptations, what's critical is whether the film, the translation to film, takes advantage of the unique properties of film to do something about that story that's new and interesting and fresh. not about preserving slavishly every aspect of the original written word. And I think that applies in translation.
Well, I'm glad that I opened this conversation and themed it to discussing translation and using that, not only because it was just fascinating, but using that also as a leverage to discussing your work and your writing, because you've given me, I was already interested in translation, and now I'm becoming fixated after this conversation, because you've expressed the concept of translation almost as a philosophy of looking at cultural aspects of the world.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I kind of agree with that, yes.
And I'm going to take that to heart.
Well, thank you.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to end this part of the interview, and I hope that we get to do more.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this.
We only scratched the surface of things we can talk about.
Right.
We haven't discussed the meanings of paper menagerie or any of that stuff, but it was a wonderful.
This was a fun conversation. I really had.
And I can't thank you enough for being
here. Thank you very much, Jim.
And you've been listening to an interview with Ken Liu, LIU, conducted last March at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art in the basement, just before we had done a New York Review of Science Fiction reading based on Oz. I had mentioned at the top of the show, by the way, that this was to coincide with the release of that new movie that Sam Raimi put out. And I finally saw it, and you know what? It sucked. I mean, I like Sam Raimi movies for their cheesiness and their fun and all that. And this story, it just had no life to it whatsoever. The China Doll was great, and beyond that, no big deal. But Ken Liu was certainly fascinating and interesting, and I'm very grateful to him for having taken the time out to record that additional interview, and hopefully our paths will cross again somewhere soon. You can find him online, Google his name up, again, Ken, and then LIU. And I can also recommend that there are a few podcasts of readings of Ken Liu's work and his translations. I believe at both Clark's World magazine, where Kate Baker does the readings, and at Lightspeed magazine, where recently I have become the host. But just Google it up and let the hits fall where they may. And I should outro the whole thing properly, saying that this is Hour of the Wolf, over listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM, and over WBAI.org. And my name is Jim Freund. This is the 42nd, more or less, anniversary of this program. Margot Adler began Hour of the Wolf in January of 1972. And she did the show 5 days a week. I was her co-host on Thursdays and Fridays, which were the science fiction mornings. And sometime about approximately 2 years later, I had taken the show over. And Margot, of course, now is mostly with NPR, but also turning out books and appearing in any number of places, and hopefully is going to be on the program in the next month or so. She has a new book coming out called Vampires Are Us, and you may have heard me play her sermon. She calls it her vampire sermon on vampires in politics and today's culture, and it's not as obvious as you would think. Any more that when she wrote the definitive book on neo-paganism, Drawing Down the Moon, people said, oh, it's about witches. No, it's not what you think. So, nevertheless, the point is that this is an anniversary of sorts for the program. We'll keep celebrating it next week because we're not sure which day the program began. We just know that it began in January of 1972, and we're going to leave it at that. So, next week on Hour of the Wolf, my guest is going to be Nancy Hightower, and She's a fascinating writer. She has her doctorate. I forget in what exactly, but suffice it to say that it involves mythology and fantasy and things like that. And she will be reading from her debut novel, Elementary, that's with an I on the end, Elementary Rising. And she'll be talking about the reading that she will be doing for the public the week after with D.T. Friedman, who was on the program a couple of months ago. And that's going to be Tuesday, February 4th at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, free admission, doors open 6:30, blah, 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 blah. I'll talk about that more a great deal. Also, by the way, if you want, you can go to the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook, or you can go to the NYRSF group, that's NYRSF, as in New York Review for Science Fiction, readings group, also on Facebook, and get more announcements there. So, thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. If you would like to write me, you can certainly do so. Care of OurWolf.com, that would be Jim at HOURWOLF.com, or you can try Facebook. At any rate, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister, hopefully not snowed out and coming your way over these airwaves. Take care and have a wonderful morning.
You're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, WBAI.org.
I am a proletarian. I am a fish.
I am a red part of the blues that on you.
great show. Jim Freund, 99 Cinco, 3 o'clock on the dot. Flag burning time right here. Are you ready for the Ganja Bowl? The Ganja Bowl, y'all.
Red, white, and blue, I'm not Captain America. Too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria. Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bowl lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
99 Cinco list alive until 5 o'clock. Burn, baby, burn. Minutes after 3 o'clock right here. 212-209-2900. Burn, baby, burn. Where we burn the imperialist flag, the red, white, and blue, to ashes before 3 o'clock. We practice that, you know, so we get good by 5 o'clock. You know what I mean? Burn, baby, burn. 99 Cinco, where you belong. Don't forget, we gotta be fundraising, and you know what to do. The whole damn station is gonna be the premium. I'm glad WBAI came to their senses and realized that's the best premium in the world. Burn, baby, burn.
El Banjito, Gita Vaz.